Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. Every fall, I dedicate one episode to some of the extraordinary poems prompted by the First World War. They have a historical value, certainly, but they also articulate universal concerns. The theme for today's episode is Remembering the First World War. One details the life of a veteran who managed to survive the carnage and reflects on, or tries not to reflect on, his specific experiences from the war. Also, we'll hear a couple of poems that depict civilians beginning to come to terms with their memories of the suffering shared throughout England. Let's consider British soldier poet Edmund Blunden's The Veteran. The title on its own, the first words we encounter, signal what we need to imagine, a First World War vet. Soon into the poem, we understand the vet is a silver-haired, aged beekeeper moving about in his thriving garden. Though alone in this setting, his joy is childlike. He babbles to himself about the organic abundance he's immersed in. Only a few lines in the second half of the poem reveal the inner turmoil he carries. Then the closing lines suggest his sleep is disturbed by memories of his experiences in the war. The poet, Edmund Blunden, himself a vet, avoids specific examples of the disturbing memories. This is Edmund Blunden's The Veteran. He stumbles silver-haired among his bees, now with the warm sun mantling him. He plods, taking his honey under the pippin trees, where every sprig with rich red harvest nods. He marks the skies intense, and like a child, his joy still springing new, in this fantastic garden the year through, he steeps himself in nature's opulence. Mellow between the leafy maize smiles down September's sun, swelling his multitude of gold and red and green and russet brown, lavished in plenty's lusty-handed mood for this old man who goes beckoning ripeness, shoring the lolling sprays and fruits which early gusts made castaways from the deep grasses, thriftily rescuing those. Babble he will, lingeringly, lovingly, of all the glories of this fruitful place, counting the virtues of each several tree, her years, her yield, her hardihood or grace, while through this triumph song, as through their shielding leaves, the year's fruits burn in bright eye-cozening color, turn by turn, from black cherries till gold quinces throng, blossoming the blue mist with their queenly scent. Who, hearing him, can think what dragging years of drouthy raids and frontier fights he spent, with drum and fife to drown his clamoring fears? Here, where the grapes turn red on the red walls, and honey in the hives is like drift snow, contentment only thrives, and the long misery of the line is dead. Resting in his old oaken-raftered room, he sits and watches the departing light crimsoning like his apple trees in bloom, with dreaming gratitude and calm delight, and fast the peering sun has lit the blue delft ranged along the wall, the painted clock and squirrel's funeral, and through the cobwebs traced his rusty gun. And then the dusk, and sleep, and while he sleeps, apple scent floods, and honey's fragrance there, and old-time wines, whose secret he still keeps, are beautiful upon the marveling air. And if sleep seem unsound, and set old bugles pealing through the dark, waked on the instant, he but wakes to hark his bellman cockerel crying the first round. Edmund Blunden's The Veteran. After 25 lines detailing the man in his garden, the poem's speaker asks, if anyone overhears the veteran babbling in delight, who could possibly imagine what he silently carries inside himself? There's a reference to the dragging years of drothy raids and frontier fights he spent with drum and fife to drown his clamoring fears. Admittedly, that language is nonspecific, even abstract. The word drothy, a variation on draught, suggests the dryness to the landscape, the lack of organic growth, trees blown up, and certainly no bees buzzing. The fourth stanza concludes, and the long misery of the line is dead. The first letter in the word line is uppercase. Blunden refers to the extended line of trenches along the Western Front, where so much of the actual fighting was conducted, where men were locked in stalemate positions in miserable weather for seemingly endless periods. Nobody overhears this veteran's babbling to his bees and flowers because he's absolutely solitary in his garden. Blunden does not hint at whether his apparent psychological stability has been achieved despite or because he's cut off from a human community. Whatever post-war trauma he experiences is negligible. His daytime outdoor chores bring him peace. Inside his old oaken-raftered room, there are homey items, blue Delft, a painted clock, and Squirrel's Funeral, which has an uppercase S and F, and I'm guessing refers to a kitschy-like painting. Also, there are cobwebs on his rusty gun. Apparently, he has no interest in firing it at any creature. The final lines suggest how he handles his potential nightmares. This, again, is the final stanza of Edmund Blunden's The Veteran. And then the dusk, and sleep, and while he sleeps, apple scent floods, and honey's fragrance there, and old-time wines, whose secret he still keeps, are beautiful upon the marveling air. And if sleep seem unsound, and set old bugles pealing through the dark, waked on the instant, he but wakes to hark his bellman cockerel crying the first round. As with the earlier reference to drothy raids, there's a generic abstracted quality to these potential nightmares. If his sleep is unsound, if he thinks he hears bugles that in his years in the trenches would call him to go over the top, now that sound stimulates him to wake up. And the poet says he wakes on the instant and hears his bellman cockerel crying the first round. A bellman cockerel seems to refer to a young rooster. This silver-haired, aged vet is pulled away from his nightmare before it even begins to unfold. In his bed, he's reminded of his rural setting that has no relation to the Western Front. Rather than The Veteran, should Edmund Blunden have titled this poem A Successful Repression of War Experience? It astonishes me that the poem was published in 1919, 1 year after the war's end, when Edmund Blunden was merely 23 years old, a very young veteran. So this is a highly imaginative projection into the future, many decades later, when the vet is aged and silver-haired. Like Blunden's poem, the title of Ursula Roberts' poem, The Cenotaph, gives us our bearings. If we read her poem without the reference her title provides, we could be lost in a mystery. The cenotaph is the sculpture of an empty tomb located on a busy London street. It's a vertical slab of marble. Unveiled on November 11, 1920, this tall, relatively unadorned sculpture represents absent dead British soldiers, so many of whom were buried near where they died along the Western Front. No religious message is conveyed in the design of the cenotaph, nor does it broadcast any note of triumph. So, viewers may project their own emotions on it. And Ursula Roberts allows us to glimpse some of the range of emotions during a wreath-laying ceremony. This is Ursula Roberts' poem, The Cenotaph. The man in the trilby hat has furtively shifted it. The man with the clay pipe has pushed his fists deeper into his pockets. Beparceled women are straining their necks to stare through the spattered windows of the omnibus we see, dumb beneath the rain, marshaled by careful policemen, four behind four, the relatives of dead heroes, clutching damp wreaths. Within the omnibus there is silence, but for a sniff. Then a plump woman speaks, softly, unquerulously. "I wouldn't," she says, "I wouldn't stand in a queue to have my feelings harrowed. No, myself, I wouldn't." The omnibus swerves to the pavement, and the plump woman prepares for equable departure. "But there," she adds unbitterly, "I often think it wouldn't do for us all to be alike. There's some as can't, but then again, there's some, you see, as can." Beautiful, plump woman, plump of mind as well as of body, beautiful is your tolerance of human idiosyncrasy. When my impatient feet would tap in irritation, when my breath would break out in abuse, when my scornful lips would frame themselves at the vices or at the virtues of my neighbors, into a sneer only half pitiful, may I remember you and murmur with serenity, without intensity, without virulence, "I wouldn't, not myself, but then again, there's some, you see, as can." Ursula Roberts, The Cenotaph. This is a quiet, understated poem, as remarkable for what it says as for what it leaves out. Americans, of course, may visit the tomb of the unknown soldier in Arlington National Cemetery, if you want to make a special trip to Washington, D.C. to do so. The Brits chose to place their memorial to the absent dead of the First World War in a congested urban area, where even in 1920, cars and omnibuses would pass right by. The controlling voice of Roberts' poem details passengers on a London omnibus silently viewing the relatives of dead heroes carrying damp wreaths to place at the base of the cenotaph. We don't hear any of these relatives speak, nor any politicians speak on this occasion. The only person overheard is a plump woman departing the bus who comments to no one in particular on the actions of the relatives. She says, "I wouldn't stand in a queue to have my feelings harrowed." Aware she may have sounded more judgmental than she intended, she softens her view. "Not myself, I wouldn't. But then again, there's some, you see, as can." The controlling voice of the poem then reasserts itself and draws a direct lesson for herself about how she views her own neighbors. She seems to realize we all mourn in our own ways, and acceptance of the grief of others is essential. The plump woman's brief statement gets repeated at the poem's end. In simple terms, Roberts pleads for peace in the everyday thoughts and habits of her readers. Let's hear the poem once more. Ursula Roberts, The Cenotaph. The man in the trilby hat has furtively shifted it. The man with the clay pipe has pushed his fists deeper into his pockets. Beparceled women are straining their necks to stare. Through the spattered windows of the omnibus, we see, dumb beneath the rain, marshaled by careful policemen, four behind four, the relatives of dead heroes, clutching damp wreaths. Within the omnibus there is silence, but for a sniff. Then a plump woman speaks, softly, unquerulously. "I wouldn't," she says, "I wouldn't stand in the queue to have my feelings harrowed. No, myself, I wouldn't." The omnibus swerves to the pavement, and the plump woman prepares for equable departure. "But there," she adds unbitterly, "I often think it wouldn't do for us all to be alike. There's some as can't, but then again, there's some, you see, as can." Beautiful, plump woman, plump of mind as well as of body, beautiful is your tolerance of human idiosyncrasy. When my impatient feet would tap in irritation, when my breath would break out in abuse, when my scornful lips would frame themselves at the vices or at the virtues of my neighbors into a sneer only half pitiful, may I remember you and murmur with serenity, without intensity, without virulence, "I wouldn't, not myself, but then again, there's some, you see, as can." I'm struck by the very British-sounding plump woman's line, "I wouldn't stand in a queue to have my feelings harrowed." The First World War ended in 1918, and this poem was first published in 1922. But even with the passage of a few years, the survivors' emotions continued to distress them. A harrow first breaks up and then evens off plowed ground. When applied to the public displays of grief, such as laying wreaths at the cenotaph, the participants' emotional suffering might be first reinvigorated and then eased by the ceremony. Ursula Roberts certainly is not saying she knows how mourning rituals should be conducted, whether in private or in public. A nation that experienced such unfathomable losses must feel its way forward through grief. The surviving family members especially may feel their grief as a peculiarly alien force. British soldiers who died away from home were not allowed to have their bodies returned to England for burial. In small towns throughout England, church bells might announce the deaths of soldiers, but the corpses of those soldiers would never be returned for burial in the local churchyard. Surviving family members would need to travel to cemeteries in France or Belgium to lay flowers at the grave of their loved one. That is, if their loved one's body was recovered and identified. This fact magnifies the symbolic importance of the cenotaph. How come the bodies of British soldiers were not returned for home burial? There were overwhelming practical reasons. The difficulty of preserving a corpse for transport homeward when the forces were often under constant bombardment from relatively close range. Also, and this figure is hard to grasp, over 500,000 bodies of United Kingdom soldiers were either unidentified or disappeared, that is, blown up or absorbed into the mud. Our final poem treats with very dark humor the circumstance of tourists visiting the trenches shortly after the war has ended. The speaker, the representative of a company conducting such a tour in France, guides tourists, points out what they should notice, and warns them to treat the site with respect. No controlling voice steps into the poem to put this tour in context. We hear only the guide's voice. This is Philip Johnstone's High Wood. Ladies and gentlemen, this is High Wood, called by the French Bois de Fourneaux, the famous spot, which in 1916, July, August, and September, was the scene of long and bitterly contested strife by reason of its high commanding site. Observe the effect of shell fire in the trees standing and fallen. Here is wire. This trench, for months inhabited, 12 times changed hands. They soon fall in. Used later as a grave. It has been said on good authority that in the fighting for this patch of wood were killed somewhere above 8,000 men, of whom the greater part were buried here. This mound on which you stand being, madame, please, you are requested kindly not to touch or take away the company's property as souvenirs. You'll find we have on sale a large variety, all guaranteed. As I was saying, all is as it was. This is an unknown British officer, the tunic having lately rotted off. Please follow me, this way. The path, sir, please. The ground, which was secured at great expense, the company keeps absolutely untouched. And in that dugout, genuine, we provide refreshments at a reasonable rate. You are requested not to leave about paper or ginger beer bottles or orange peel. There are waste paper baskets at the gate. Philip Johnstone's High Wood. Over 8,000 men are thought to be buried at this site of extended trench warfare. Their bodies, we may presume, were never located, or at least never identified. That's one startling feature of this poem. All these tourists literally walk over unmarked graves. Also, at least one corpse in its disintegrating uniform, an unknown British officer, remains on view. Obviously, to present a corpse as a subject for tourist gawking is grotesque. The tour guide scolds one of the curious. No souvenir hunting is allowed. There's a gift shop for battle memorabilia. All the contents of the trench are considered company property, which certainly strains our belief in the circumstance of this poem. Refreshments, the guide continues, are available in a dugout, that is, a roof-covered shelter dug into the side of the trench, typically used as an officer's only slightly less primitive quarters than the trench that serves as the enlisted men's home all day and all night. I call the tone of this poem very darkly humorous. I suspect the poet is mocking folks who think they will understand the complexity of the war and the powerful emotional responses it provoked by taking such a tour of a trench. Furthermore, the poem was published in February 1918, many months before Armistice Day. The author, Philip Johnstone, was himself injured while fighting at High Wood in the Battle of the Somme. We may guess that while the war raged around him, he anticipated it would not be remembered with much respect. Again, this is Philip Johnstone's High Wood. Ladies and gentlemen, this is High Wood, called by the French Bois de Fourneaux, the famous spot which in 1916, July, August, and September, was the scene of long and bitterly contested strife by reason of the high commanding site. Observe the effect of shell fire in the trees standing and fallen. Here is wire. This trench, for months inhabited, 12 times changed hands. They soon fall in. Used later as a grave. It has been said, on good authority, that in the fighting for this patch of wood were killed somewhere above 8,000 men, of whom the greater part were buried here. this mound on which you stand being... Madame, please, you are requested kindly not to touch or take away the company's property as souvenirs. You'll find we have on sale a large variety, all guaranteed. As I was saying, all is as it was. This is an unknown British officer, the tunic having lately rotted off. Please follow me. This way. The path, sir, please. The ground, which was secured at great expense, the company keeps absolutely untouched. And in that dugout, genuine, we provide refreshments at a reasonable rate. You are requested not to leave about paper or ginger beer bottles or orange peel. There are waste paper baskets at the gate. Philip Johnstone's High Wood. After scolding a tourist to stay on the path, the tour guide remarks, "The ground which was secured at great expense, the company keeps absolutely untouched." The secure ground was achieved at the dead soldier's expense. Johnstone not so subtly mocks the tourist company for taking credit for the land. Today's episode provides just a few glimpses from two soldier poets, Edmund Blunden and Philip Johnstone, and one civilian, Ursula Roberts. All episodes of Poems for Company are archived at KMUN.org. Our theme music is Philip Ahlberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company, and please tune in for next month's show as well.